For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is May the 15th, and we're in Parshas Tzav. Last time we read up to the end of the paragraph, we're really up to on page 570. We got up to Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. However, we have to go back because we didn't finish the last part of this paragraph about the fire. So we'll start from Pasuk Hey, verse 5 on page 568. Yeah. Now, with this paragraph, as we mentioned last week, discusses the burning of the fats and limbs that need to be burned on the Mizbeach, on the altar. And at the end, here we have a discussion specifically about the fire. Even though the fire was already mentioned back in Pasuk Beis, in verse 2, it says, Ve'esh ha-Mizbeach tukad bo, the fire of the altar shall burn in it. But here it says, V'ra'esh ala mizbeach tukad bo, the fire on the altar will burn on it. Lo sichbe, it may not be extinguished. Uvier aleha hakohen etzim baboker baboker, the kohen will burn upon it wood every single morning. V'arach aleha ha'ola, he will arrange upon it the ola, meaning the tamid. V'hiktir aleha chelvea shlamim, and he'll burn upon it the fats of the shlamim. Eish tamid to kar al mizbeach, a constant fire will burn on the mizbeach, lo sichbe, it shall not be extinguished. So, we have several points to make about the fire on the altar. There is a prohibition of lo sichbe, one is not allowed to extinguish the fire on the altar. If one does extinguish the fire on the altar, it is a lav, it is a prohibition in the Torah. That is a sin to extinguish the fire on the altar. Now, there was a miracle that there was a constantly burning flame. And in fact, we will learn later, Mitzvah Shem, that when they traveled in the wilderness and they covered the altar with a leather covering, prior to doing that, they would take a metal bowl and turn it over on top of the flame before covering the altar and traveling with it. And it was miraculous that fire would never go out. It would remain burning. And that was the fire that came down from heaven that burned on the altar, which we will learn about, Mirtzah Hashem, in Parashas Shmini. The next parasha, we'll learn about a fire coming down from heaven and burning on the altar. After they constructed the Mishkan, and on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the fire came down from heaven and burned on the altar, and it remained burning. It did not go out. But nevertheless, the Torah does make a specific prohibition against someone who puts out the fire on the altar. Besides the prohibition against putting it out, there's also a requirement to perpetuate the fire. As it says in Pasuk Hey, in verse 5, Uvir aleha hakohen etzim baboker baboker, the kohen would burn on it wood every single morning. There was a mitzvah each morning for the kohen to put shnei gizrei etzim, two logs of wood, on the fire, which would, these very, very large logs of wood, which would burn the entire day on the fire of the altar. And the next morning, more wood would have to be added to the altar. The wood of the for the altar was donated by people, and it was considered to be a particularly high honor to have the privilege of donating the wood to the Beis HaMikdash. We don't think of firewood as the necessity and the commodity that it was, because we don't burn wood, generally speaking. We burn gas or oil or something like that. But prior to the discovery of and the harnessing of natural gas and oil, or coal for that matter, wood was the most common fuel for fire. And it was considered to be a very great commodity. The Gemara tells us that when the Romans laid siege to Yerushalayim at the end of the Second Temple era, Yerushalayim was very well provided for to withstand a siege. And the Gemara says they could have withstood a siege for 21 years. That's how well provided for they were. And so the Gemara says that the wealthy people of Yerushalayim, it lists various ones, one said that he could provide for all of Yerushalayim for 21 years all the wheat and barley that they needed. The second one says he could provide all of the oil and the salt. And there was one more commodity that he had. Oil means not to burn. Oil means, well, partially to burn, but also cooking. And it was a third commodity. Oil, salt. I don't remember the third thing. And the third person said he could provide for 21 years all the firewood necessary, all the fuel necessary. And the Gemara says that the sages praised the third one the most, because it takes a lot more space, you need a lot more storage space for fuel, for the wood, than you need for everything else. It takes a lot more to take care of that. Unfortunately, they did not withstand the siege, because there were Biruni, there were hotheads who wanted to fight the Romans, and in order to force a war, they burned down the storehouses of wheat and barley, causing a great famine. And a lot of people starved to death because of that. It was a terrible thing. But the point that we're trying to make from there is that the firewood was considered to be a very, very significant commodity. So it's considered to be an honor to have the privilege of providing the Beis HaMikdash with firewood. And certain families had certain dates on the calendar that were their personal holidays, because that was the date on the calendar where they would bring truckloads worth of firewood to the Beis HaMikdash. It was all in the summertime, well, spring and summer, because once you get to the winter months, the fire, if you have wood, it's not dried out. Wood that is not dried will not burn properly. So it needs to be dried out over the hot months, and then they're brought to the Beis HaMikdash. And certain families had very large access to very large tracts of wood that they could provide to the Beis HaMikdash. So there is a mitzvah daily for the Kohen to add these two large logs to the fire of the altar. Now, it also calls the fire a constant fire. In Pasuk Vav, verse 6, Eish Tamid, a constant fire. Now, the word Tamid, which means constant, means the specific meaning of the word Tamid varies from context to context. Here, the word tamid means all the time. The fire had to burn 24/7. There is something else in the Beis HaMikdash which needed to be there all the time, and that was the bread on the, well, it's not really bread, but the lechem on the shulchan. Well, there is a difference of opinion when they switched one set of 12 loaves for the next set of 12 loaves. But according to one opinion, as you were taking one out, you had to slide the other one in. It had to be, the shelf was open on two sides. And as one coin pulled out the old one, the second coin pushed in the new one. So that there was never a moment that the shulchan, that the table, was breadless. It always had to have the lechem hapanim on the shulchan. That there it also says tamid, and tamid there means all the time, just like tamid over here with the fire means all the time. But tamid doesn't have to mean all the time. For example, you have the karban hatamid, the tamid which is brought as a sacrifice, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. There tamid means daily, not all the time. It means consistently, daily. every single day there had to be two tabits. So that doesn't mean all the time, it means every day. Similarly, it says with the menorah, that the menorah had to burn tamid all the time. We have a ner tamid and a shul to mimic the ner tamid of the menorah, but the truth is the menorah only had to stay lit all night, every night. It did not have to stay lit during the day. Even though there was a miracle that one of the lights did stay lit every all day long until the Kohen actually manually extinguished it in order to clean it out and start anew. But the mitzvah of tamid, of constant, that it says with the menorah actually means every night, all night. But it does not mean 24/7. Here, the word tamid means 24/7. The fire had to be there all the time on the Mizbeach, and it was a mitzvah for the Kohanim to ensure that the fire would remain constant. Now, there is a difference of opinion amongst the Tanoim, the sages of the Mishnah, how many fires were there on top of the altar. The altar was a very big space. It was 24 amos, the top of the altar, was 24 amos by 24 amos. An ama is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So even if we take the smallest estimation of what an ama is, it was 36 feet by 36 feet, which is far larger than the room we're in right now. So that was the very top of the Mizbeach. So there was a lot of space on top of the Mizbeach. The very center of the Mizbeach had the largest fire, but there are opinions that there were either two, three, or four fires burning on top of the Mizbeach. Why would there be more or fewer fires? Because the fires of the Mizbeach were actually used for several things, not just for one thing. And the difference of opinion is, do you need a separate fire for each of the uses of the fire of the Mizbeach? So what do I mean? So the main use of the fire of the Mizbeach was to burn what?
Carbonos.
To burn the carbonos, the fats, the limbs of the animals that had to be burned. That's the main use of the fire of the Mizbeach. But there is also a Gemara that tells us that the fire of the menorah came from the fire of the Mizbeach, which means when the Kohen wanted to light the menorah every single night, he would get the fire from the outside Mizbeach. The Torah mandates that the fire come from the outside Mizbeach. Not only that, but when the Kohen had to burn Ketores, incense, on the inside Mizbeach, he had to burn the incense partially in the morning, partially in the afternoon, that fire to burn the incense had to come from the outside Mizbeach. So they're burning something on the inside Mizbeach, but the fire came from the outside Mizbeach. Plus, we know that when the Kohen on Yom Kippur took coals into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, into the Holy of Holies, where he would burn incense in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, those coals were taken specifically from the outside Mizbeach. So all fire usages of the Beis HaMikdash came from the outside Mizbeach. It was the source of all the fire. There was no independent fire on the inside Mizbeach, or for the menorah, or for the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It all came from the outside Mizbeach. So the difference of opinion is, do you need a separate fire on the outside Mizbeach, for example, for the menorah, and a separate fire on the outside Mizbeach, which would be used for the inside Mizbeach? So that's the difference of, or can you just combine them into one large fire, and the fire is being taken from there?
Yeah.
So be that as it, whatever that, we don't need to get into the specifics of how many fires there were, but it is worthwhile noting that all of the fire needs came from the outside Mizbeach. Now, yeah.
Could that be why the halacha says on a yantif, you can't extinguish, you have to take it from an existing source?
No. That's a malacha. That's because that's a specific halacha of doing malacha, doing work on yantif. Now, we discussed, when we talked about the construction of the Mishkan in Parashas Terumah, we talked about the fact that we know that the holiest place of the Mishkan and of the Beis HaMikdash is the Kodesh HaKadosh and the Holy of Holies. That's the holiest place. But the most used place, or they would say in today's parlance, the most happening place of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash was the outside Mizbeach. The outside Mizbeach was where all the action was. Yes, the menorah had to be lit. Yes, incense had to be burned. Yes, the lechem ha'parim, the showbread had to be dealt with. But the main action was on the outside Mizbeach. That's what that was used, not just daily, it was used constantly for karbanos on the outside Mizbeach. And we learned last week, even all night, there were things burning there all night. So the outside Mizbeach is where the action is, and when the Gemara discusses the particular not dimensions but the particular placement of the Beis HaMikdash on the Har HaBayis, on the Temple Mount, where should the Beis HaMikdash go? And today, if we're trying to examine the evidence of where specifically would the Beis HaMikdash go, there are really two different discussions. Where is the Kodesh HaKadoshim? And where does the Mizbeach, the outside Mizbeach, go? When you have those two things, you can figure out everything else. But those two are very, very specific. We mentioned when we talked about the Mizbeach that Hashem took the dirt from which He made Adam HaRishon. He made Adam from the dirt of the Mizbeach, the outside Mizbeach. That's the dirt that He took, the dirt that would eventually be used for the outside Mizbeach. That's the dirt He took to make Adam HaRishon. So, in a sense, we all come from the dirt of the outside Mizbeach. So again, the holiest place, what's that?
In Yerushalayim.
In Yerushalayim, yeah. Yeah, the one in Yerushalayim. It's true that the holiest place is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but the one that really represents the Beis HaMikdash, what's going on in the Beis HaMikdash, it is the outside Mizbeach. There's even a discussion about constructing an outside Mizbeach without the rest of the Beis HaMikdash, in theory. Could we do that?
Weather didn't affect anything.
That was one of the miracles, that the rain did not put out the fire. That's one of the constant miracles that took place in the Beis HaMikdash, that the rain didn't affect it. Neither did the wind. The wind didn't affect it. The wind didn't blow the fire, the smoke of the fire, off in different directions. It wasn't like, I don't know if you...
always went up?
It always went up, yes, yes. If you've ever been here for the burning of the chametz on Erev Pesach is often a windy day.
Yeah, it's
transitional time there in the spring. And so you go there and you kind of have to keep moving around because you don't want the smoke blowing in your face. Right? So the...
It's always all the way to my house.
Okay. So the smoke of the maracha, of the altar, was not affected by the wind. There was another one of the miracles. It went straight up. So
were these miracles in the second temple just like they were?
So that is a discussion, which miracles did take place in the second temple. This one seems to have taken place in the second temple as well. The source of the fire comes from the outside Mizbeach, even for the menorah, for the ketores, the inside Mizbeach, and for the Kodesh HaKadoshim, for the Holy of Holies. So just to go back to, we talked about this when we talked about the construction, but just to go back to conceptually understanding what's happening. When you think about the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan, you think about the holiness emanating from where? The Kodesh HaKadosh and the Holy of Holies, which that's the holiest place. So you think about it as that's where, so to speak, Hashem's Shekhinah, Hashem's Divine Presence, rests there and then emanates outward to the rest of the Beis HaMikdash, to the rest of the Har HaBayis, Temple Mount, to the rest of Yerushalayim, to the rest of Eretz Yisrael, to the rest of the world. But that's where it all comes from. And that is an appropriate way to think about it. But here you have a little bit of a reverse. The fire that is needed for the menorah, the fire that is needed for the inside Mizbeach, the Ketores, the fire that is needed even for the Kodesh HaKadoshim, for the Holy of Holies, that emanates from the outside Mizbeach going in. So that there is this constant, the holiness is coming from inside to outside, but the fire is going from outside to inside. And when that fire first was lit by Hashem, it came from the heavens straight down to the Mizbeach. It didn't go through the Kodesh HaKadosh. There was a heavenly fire that came down to the Mizbeach and burned up the sacrifices, and it is from there that the fire is taken inside. So there is an element here of what we might think of as of a reverse, a going against the traffic kind of thing, which we might not have intuited on our own.
So you could say it's a dichotomy, but you'd also say that God went before the Jewish people with a pillar of fire.
Good.
And he humbled himself. You know, God can do anything and he could get through the desert in a minute, right?
Right.
So he humbled himself to be with us. We're not going to have a Mishkan if our behavior is not okay and our behavior towards other Jews is not okay.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter how many sacrifices you do. If the Kedusha is not coming from the Jewish people...
Okay. Okay, so this seems to represent the Jewish people's responding properly, as you said, to Hashem's presence. And as Hashem's presence is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, emanating forward from there, and we have to respond by behaving properly, by serving properly, and that sends fire. You need them both. You need our contribution. In fact, we will learn later that although fire comes down from heaven, it is still a mitzvah for us to light our own fire. They're both, it's true fire came down from heaven, but there's still a mitzvah lahavi min ha-hedyot. There's a mitzvah to bring from the hedyot. Hedyot means a regular person, meaning us, not from God. So even though Hashem is providing the fire, we don't rely on that fire. We provide our own fire. We put wood on the Mizbeach to keep the fire going. It's got to be a two-way street. When we do perform as we are supposed to, so there is a two-way street, then it is our fire that is brought inside to the menorah, to the inside Mizbeach, even to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, even to the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. It comes from our fire. So it is very important to note how it is a two-way street. Hashem wants us to contribute. As you said, he could have done it all by himself. He wants us to contribute. When we do contribute, he values that contribution, makes us feel like our contribution is valued, and uses it in, or has us use it, even in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and certainly for the menorah and for the inside Mizbeach. Baruch atah Adonai Elohim Melech Haolam
she'akol
mitbarach. Okay, so there we have the discussion of the fires of the Mizbeach. Now we're up to Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, and as we're going to continue in the same theme we've mentioned before, which is that Parashas Tzav discusses the same karbonos that were mentioned in Parashas Vayikra, but now discussing details that were not mentioned there, and Hashem chose to put them in a different parasha. So the first paragraph was particularly about the ola, the carbon that is completely burned. Now we move on to the mincha, and we'll get some details here that were not mentioned in Parashas Vayikra. V'zos toras ha-mincha, this is the law of the mincha. Ha-krev ho-sa b'nei Aaron lifnei Hashem, the children of Aaron shall bring it before Hashem. El Pnei HaMizbeach, to the front of the Mizbeach. We learned before that the one of the mitzvos of the Mincha is that the Mincha, which is the flower offering, needs to be brought close to the southwestern corner of the Mizbeach. You take the Mincha in its bowl, and you bring it, and the Kohen brings it close to or over the southwest corner of the Mizbeach. Why the southwest corner? Which side of the Mizbeach was the front of the Mizbeach? Front means the side where the ramp was, where you would ascend to the top of the Mizbeach. Anybody know? That was the south side. The south side was the front of the Mizbeach. Which side of the Mizbeach faced the actual Mishkan, or faced the Beis HaMikdash? So it was the west side. The west side faced the Mishkan, or the Kodesh HaKodesh. So that was the, in a certain sense, the holiest side, because it faced the sanctuary. But the south side was the front of the Mizbeach. So the southwest corner combines the front of the Mizbeach with the side that is the holiest side. That is the corner that the Kohen is to bring the Mincha and place it near that corner. Yeah.
But where did they store the ashes?
That was on the south east side, okay. Where it was hidden. Yes, okay. yes. Okay.
That's the hidden side.
Yes. Okay. If you have your markers, I would
keep forgetting. To bring
I know. Actually, as soon as I walked out the door before,
I remember.
Okay, thank you. Okay. We'll just put it up so we can see this. I think this one worked before. So we have the altar, which was a square. It has a ramp. Mm-hmm. This is the south. This is the north. And here's the east. Okay, now the west, which is this side, is to the west side of the altar, is the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodesh. That's the whole picture. But that's where you would go in, and in here you'd have the menorah, and the, you know, here's the curtain down the middle. So right. This is the west side right here.
Okay.
So the southwest corner, which is right here, combines the front of the Mizbeach and the side that faces the sanctuary. So that's the corner where the Kohen was required to bring the Mincha, to put it over there.
And also the blood, I remember, was on.
Well, the blood was in this corner and this corner.
And this corner.
Right. Yeah. Right. Now, what you asked before about the ashes were placed here because that was a secluded area. You couldn't see from there because the ramp was elevated, and it would block you couldn't from there. It would be like you kind of like tuck the dirt into a corner. That would be a good place to put it. Right. Okay. So the first thing is that the mincha is brought to the southwest corner. Then, Pasuk Ches verse 8, Vehirim mimenu bikumtso, he would lift out of it with his handful. That's the komets, the kmitza, with the three fingers over the palm and the fourth one to shave it down, to keep it smooth out. Yeah. Misoves hamincha o mishamna, from the flour of the mincha and from its oil. Ve'es kol halivona asher al hamincha, and all of the spices that were on the mincha. And then he would burn on the Mizbeach, he would burn the handful plus the spices. Reach nichoach, a pleasant smell, as kara sala Hashem, its remembrance to Hashem. There's no blood to put on the Mizbeach. There are no fats to burn on the Mizbeach. So what gets burned on the Mizbeach? The kmitza, the handful that was taken, would get burned on the Mizbeach. Vanoseres imena yochlu Aaron uvanav. The leftovers would be eaten by Aaron and his sons. Matzos teachel b'makom kadosh. It shall be eaten as matzah. Remember, we talked about this in Parashas Vayikra, that it was Pesach all year round in the Beis Hamikdash. Virtually all of the flour karbanos were matzah. not chametz, including the show bread, despite the English word bread. It was not bread, it was matzah. So here, as well, the menachos, the mincha, the flour offering, had to be matzah. So eaten as matzah in a holy place. Bachatzar ohel moed yochluha, in the courtyard of the Mishkan, it would be eaten. The mincha has a halacha of kodshei kodshim, which is the higher status of karbonos, and it had to be eaten not in the entire camp of the Levim, which corresponds to the city of Yerushalayim. Rather, it had to be eaten only in the courtyard of the Mishkan. And then finally, it says, "Lo se'afeh chametz." It shall not be baked as chametz. Chelkam nasati osa me'ishai. Their portion, meaning the Kohen's portion, I've given it to him from my, literally means from my flame. It means from that which is offered to me, I have given it to the Kohen. Kodesh Kadashim hi, it is Kodesh Kadashim, it's a higher level of Kedusha, of sanctity. Kachatas v'cha asham, like a chatas and like an asham, that it is of an elevated status. Now, I want to point out to you what the Gemara says over here, which is, we've mentioned that the Kmitza cannot be chametz. How do you know that which the Kohanim eat also cannot be chametz? So you learn that from here, because it says, Lo se'afeh chametz, it shall not be baked as chametz, chelkam, their portion. So we derive from there, their portion cannot be baked as chametz. It has to remain as matzah. Finally, Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, Kol zachar b'vnei Aaron yochelena, all males of the children of Aaron may eat it, not females. Chak olam l'doro seichem, it is a statute forever for all your generations, me'ishei Hashem, from the offerings of Hashem. Kol asher yigab mohem yikdosh, anything that shall touch them will become sanctified. So first of all, we see from here that which is Kodesh Kadashim, that's the higher level of sanctity of Karbanos, was limited only to the male Kohanim. They could not share it with their families. Kodshim Kalim, which is the lower level of the Karbanos, that could be eaten by all of the Kohanim. But Kodshei Kodshim could only be eaten by the males, and not just any of the males, only the ones who were working in the Beis HaMikdash, they could eat it. It was considered to be part of the service, just as the service of catching the blood and throwing the blood and taking the handful and all that. Eating of the mincha also was considered part of the service, and it could only be eaten by the Kohen doing the service in the Beis HaMikdash. I want to discuss the last few words of this paragraph, but before I do that, one last point over here is that the carbon of the Kohen himself would not be eaten at all. This is describing the carbon mincha of a non-Kohen, meaning if I would bring a carbon mincha, so then the Kohen would take a kmitza off, burn it, and the rest of it would be eaten by the Kohanim. If a Kohen would bring a carbon mincha, it all gets burned. None of it is eaten. We derive from here that not only is it all burned, but it also cannot become chametz, even though it's not being eaten at all. You might have thought, if I'm going to burn it anyway, what difference does it make whether it's chametz or matzah? That is not the case. It has to remain matzah, even though no one is going to be eating it. Now, the last point of anything that touches it will become sanctified is, believe it or not, relevant for us today. Now, it's not detailed over here, and in other places in the Torah it is more detailed, and when we get to it in other places in the Torah, we'll discuss it, Bli Neder, in more detail. But it is relevant to us today, which is the following. We know that there's such a thing, well, let me start this way. We know that whenever you have something that cannot be eaten, you have something that's not kosher. So we know that you obviously can't eat any part of it. So if you have non-kosher meat or non-kosher cheese, so you can't even lick it. There's none of it is allowed to be eaten. It's not just you can't have a bite. You can't eat any of it. And if any of the grease or the residue would get onto something kosher, you couldn't eat that. Let's say you had a piece of bread, and there would be some residue of non-kosher food that got smeared on the bread. Well, then you can't eat that part of the bread because the bread has that stuff on it. But we also know that there are parts or particles that are not visible to the naked eye that are also prohibited. And that is absorption, which is called ta'am, which is called taste. And we know that you can transfer ta'am, you can transfer absorption from one item to the other. What is the primary way that items get taste gets transferred?
Through heat.
So if you have a hot piece of food that is not kosher that comes in contact with kosher food, even if you would rinse off the surface of the kosher food so there's no residue left, nevertheless, the taste, the particles have gone through, and the heat is what makes it absorb the offending matter. And therefore, it cannot get eaten. That's also why we have to kosher utensils that become not kosher. Even though we may clean the pot, and the pot no longer has any residue in it, if non-kosher food was cooked in the pot, yet we still have to kosher the pot or kosher the pot with boiling water or a blowtorch, whatever system we're going to use. And the reason is because there are particles that get into the walls of the pot which are not visible to the naked eye. And it is the heat that brings it in. The Dadi Lishkov has a wonderful story, which she told us from many, many years ago, where she was once, it was the winter time, and she wanted to dye a shirt blue. She had a white shirt or t-shirt or whatever, so she wanted to dye it blue. So I think it was perhaps for one of her children that they needed it dyed blue. She had the dye, but she didn't have a pot large enough to boil the dye and to immerse the shirt. So she took out her Pesach pot, because that was a very large pot. She figured the dye isn't chametz, and she's right, the dye is not chametz. So she used the Pesach pot to boil this dye, and then to put the shirt in it. And then when she was done, she cleaned the pot, squeaky clean, and she put it away for Pesach, as fine. Then that Pesach, she took out her pot as always before Pesach, and she cooked her matzah balls, as she always does. And when she opened the lid of the pot, the matzah balls were blue. Because there was blue absorbed into the pot, which you can't see, but it's in there. And that right? It was really there, and the matzo balls were actually blue.
That's the best. This is
not even.
That is the best.
This is all the base of Mikdash in Yerushalayim and what you do. What went with the people for the 40 years?
The Mishkan. The Mishkan.
Just the Mishkan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It traveled.
Well, there's a problem because the faucet isn't cleaned for Pesach.
The faucet.
The faucet where she got that water from is not clean for Pesach.
Right. We can discuss that. Not unless it was cold water.
The fire where she cooked it on.
Okay, but it's cold water.
Yeah. It's cold water. The fire is okay. It's okay.
It's a cute story.
Now, there are other ways for what we call tam for the taste or for the particles to transfer besides heat. Heat is the most common way and is the most, it's the easiest one to understand. There are other ways. One way is through salting. Salting can also cause transfer of even cold items, but can cause a transfer of particles from one to the other.
And spices.
Okay, pickling. Pickling like in
garlic,
vinegar or something like that, onion, can also cause. And in certain circumstances, even the cutting of a knife, like when cutting an onion, even though everything's cold, can also cause a transfer. So there are certain situations where it can happen. That is what is being alluded to over here, even though it's not a lot of detail over here. And as I mentioned, there are other parts of the Torah where it is discussed in more detail. But here, the Torah says that when you have this mincha, this flower offering, it is designated as kodshei kodshim. It's the higher level of sanctity, which gives it certain rules. Certain rules we mentioned already. Only a male Kohen can eat it, number one. We didn't talk about this, but there's a time frame that he could eat it. Only for that day and that night. After that, it's too late. So there are certain rules governing it. It may not be taken out of the courtyard of the Mishkan. If it goes out of the courtyard of the Mishkan, it is possible. It's invalid.
Did it taste good?
What?
Did it taste
good? Yeah, it tasted good. But the Torah is telling us what happens if that mincha comes in contact with other food. What happens if it comes in contact with other food in a way that there would be a transfer of tam, of particles? Let's say it was hot and it came in contact with an apple. So the apple, or the apple was hot, and they touched each other, and the apple now has absorbed something from the mincha. Now you can wash off the apple. There's nothing visible on the outside of the apple, but it has absorbed. Mm-hmm. That apple will now have the same rules as the mincha. That apple can only be eaten by a male Kohen, only in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, and only for that day and the following night. Because since it absorbed from the mincha, it now has the properties of the mincha. Mm-hmm. Now we really know this because we know that if that apple would touch hot pork, we would say it takes the properties of the pork, and therefore only a non-Jew could eat it. That's what we would say. But here, it's not a question of kosher and non-kosher. They're both kosher foods, but one of the kosher foods has very severe restrictions. The other one does not. And now that it absorbs from it, it picks up all of those restrictions.
All right. So what happens to what's left of the apple, you know, the core or something? Mm. Or what if the Kohen can't eat it? No Kohen can eat it. It's holy.
Yeah.
It would
have the same rules as the leftover mincha. A leftover mincha has to get burned.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what we would say about an apple, because I don't know what we would say is edible and inedible. That's a good question. I mean, when my father eats an apple, all that's left is the little stem.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what he eats an apple. So I would assume, you know, I don't know what we would rule is considered to be the edible parts and what's not the edible parts. But if we presume the whole thing is edible, then yeah, it would have the same rules as the mincha, right? So even though here it doesn't say much, it just says whatever touches it shall become sanctified, it doesn't mean to touch, only to touch. It means to touch and absorb. If it touches and absorbs, then it will become sanctified.
It's just the opposite of becoming unkosher.
Well, yes. It is the same process.
It's the same process.
You're just saying it's the other direction. It's becoming more sanctified.
Right.
But if you think about it, But if you think about it, the mincha is actually not kosher for a non-Kohen.
Right.
But it's not kosher for a different reason. It's the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Right. So it would take on the same rules here that if other foods would touch it, and for that matter, the pots as well. The pots that would come in contact with the mincha would absorb from the mincha. You bake the mincha, or you cook the mincha, whatever it is, it's going to take on the properties of the mincha, and the pot will now have those rules. You would not be able to take that pot.
You can't reuse it.
And, well, you know, if the pot was used to bake a mincha in it, and now you take the pot and you want to use it to bake your regular challah for Shabbos, or regular matzah, let's say, you wouldn't be able to do that because whatever you baked on this pot will take out of the pot. And just like we know, if you take a non-kosher pot and try to cook your kosher food, the food's not kosher because it's taking out of that pot.
So it could be only used during that evening in that.
Okay, so we're going to learn later, what do you do with all these pots?
Yeah.
Especially, you know, we're used to metal. They didn't use metal, they used earthenware. Right. Earthenware cannot be koshered.
No, that absorbs everything.
Right. Like China. Okay, so we're going to learn later about this. This is going to be a big issue in the Beis HaMikdash and in the Mishkan. Mm-hmm. What do you do with all the utensils? Right, so we'll see. We'll see about that. So all of the, what we're used to thinking about in terms of kosher and non-kosher, and we really attempt to avoid it completely. Sometimes in the kitchen it does come up, especially, you know, milk and meat or onions. And things do happen, but we try to avoid it. And we only think of it in terms of non-kosher, right. But you see it applies to other things as well, and it happened here on a regular basis. You had essentially non-kosher food being processed in the Beis HaMikdash all the time. When I say non-kosher, I don't mean non-kosher for everybody, but not kosher for a lot of the population in the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash was essentially, for most people, a non-kosher restaurant. Right, there's a lot of food in there that regular people like myself could not eat. Now some food you could eat, but a lot of it you couldn't, and so they had to be careful about these things. Lots of mashkichim though in the
Beis HaMikdash. I'm having trouble with this because I don't think that you think of it as being non-kosher, but that there is so much at risk in the Beit HaMikdash with tavor and tameh. And if the presence of God is there, somebody could die. So it's not kosher. It's
correct.
It's taboo.
Correct. It's off limits. I'm only using the term non-kosher to give us what we're used to dealing with in this way. We're not used to dealing in this way.
We have no idea of what it's like being in a minefield of things being tamei and tahor and taboo.
Right. Now here's an interesting thing. There is a discussion in Shulchan Aruch. Let's say that you have your chicken soup and your kosher chicken soup for Shabbos. And unfortunately, somebody had something, a non-kosher ingredient, and a few drops fell into the pot. So we're familiar with the 1 to 60 ratio. Let's say you didn't know how much it was. So you didn't know whether it was 1 to 60 or not. So in Shulchan Aruch there's a discussion about giving a non-Jew some of the soup to taste so he could tell you whether he could taste any of the non-kosher ingredient. And could you rely on a non-Jew's testimony? Because he's allowed to eat it. There's nothing wrong with a non-Jew eating soup that has non-kosher ingredient in it. Nothing wrong with that. So could I ask my non-Jewish neighbor, invite him over, serve him a bowl of soup, and ask him, did you taste any of that of the pork in this soup? And if he tells me no, can I rely on that? So the discussion really revolves around two points, which are beyond the scope of our class, but I'll just mention the two points to you. One is, first of all, can you trust him? Which of course depends on the circumstances. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And second of all, not can you trust him in the sense of, the first one is can you trust whether he'll tell you the truth or not. Right. The second one is, does he have the expertise to know? You know, you have to have a discerning palate to pick up whether there is a taste of pork in there. You know, some people are better than that than others. You know, there are people, I have one child who can walk into the house and just by smelling can tell you what kind of ingredients are being used in the kitchen, all that, right? But most people are not like that. So it depends on the on whether you can. So those are the two issues. Can you trust him, and what about, does he have a discerning palate? Okay. What happens if you have your chicken soup and a few drops of truma drop into it. Now, that's different. Because here, truma is not kosher for me, but it's kosher to a kohen who is tahar. So here, it's the same question. Can I have a kohen taste it and tell me if it's okay for me? Now here, we don't worry about whether we can trust him to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. The only issue is the discerning palate. Correct. Do we say that he can pick up the taste? But I'm just pointing out to you that the same discussion in Shulchan Aruch that we have about a non-Jew tasting a potentially non-kosher food, a non-kosher ingredient, we have the same discussion about a Kohen tasting what is, again, I don't want to use the term non-kosher, but it's the same idea. That which is off-limits to me, but is okay for him, can he taste it and then let me know?
Very interesting.
Right. The same discussion. So here I'm pointing out to you the same kind of thing, even though it's a totally different direction. Right. That which is more sanctified, mm-hmm. but it's a similar idea that it's off-limits to a large portion of the population.
So it was discussed.
Yes, yeah.
And
all this
was
is
the conclusion?
It depends on circumstances. A lot of it depends on circumstances.
I'm feeling so uncomfortable about the whole thing. Just get rid of it.
It brings to a whole new level. That's, who can eat at whose house?
I'm not there. I'm not that worried.
You got kosher and you got super kosher.
That's right. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.